And we are back. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And it's time again for my favorite part of the show, the interview. And we're bringing another great one. There's two great interviews in a row. And our guest today, this is his second time on the show. But I personally think, and he wasn't on that long ago, but I think that his work in particular is really appropriate right now. It's very prescient, if you will, in my opinion. And I think the things he's focused on and his work is going to be even more relevant in the near future. Now, I could certainly be wrong. And, you know, there's no point in me going on about it. We should just get it from directly from the horse's mouth. So anyway, without further ado, I want to welcome back Edwin Dorsey to the show. Edwin, how you doing?
Zach, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
Hey, no problem, man. And we were laughing afterwards because you are by far, now I'm guesstimating on the age and you don't need to say, but you're by far the youngest guest we've ever had on. And now a two-timer. So hopefully as you get older, you'll get better. You'll develop a better taste in which invites to podcasts you accept. So anyway, hey, pal. So wanted to just kind of start from a global basis. And then, you know, I've been watching your feed here, and then I've got several specific things that you've posted about and things that you've got your eye on. But why don't we take it from you? What are you focused the most on right now? What is catching your eye the most, whether it's with individual securities or as the market as a whole? I think we both can agree there's a lot of interesting action. You know, maybe also include an update on ARK, because I think everybody just naturally assumed that, that was just a scare and ARK's off to the races again. That chart looks to be breaking down again. So anyway, you know, maybe an update on that. But the global feed, what Edwin is looking at and what's really got your attention?
So, Zach, I'm always looking to find bad companies or companies that are misleading investors or misleading customers. Naturally, I've been spending a lot of time looking at SPACs because those tend to attract a lot of low-quality companies. One company that I wrote about today is Canoe, an electric vehicle company where the general counsel, CEO, CFO, all resigned within 3 months of the company going public. So those are the types of companies I'm looking for. I'm also looking a lot in the payment space. I think there's a lot of companies that are representing themselves to be like innovative payments company, trying to like piggyback on the high valuation of Stripe and Aiden, a lot of these cool payments companies, when in reality, they're just really high risk payment providers that'll go away once the market settles down. As far as ARK goes, last time I was on, we were talking about potential liquidity issues with ARK, where if ARK ever faced significant outflows, they could be in trouble because then they'd need to sell a lot of their holdings, many of which are illiquid, which would drive down the price of those holdings, which could make performance deteriorate more, which could lead to more outflows, and which could start this death spiral. And what's been bad for ARK is now, over the last 2-3 months, they've had consistent underperformance, underperforming the market by like 20 or 30%. And I think the longer you outperform, the more likely it is that you start to lose the retail base and get outflow. So I think the liquidity problems are still very real. One figure I read is that 40% of ARK's assets are in companies where they own 10% or more of the company, which means if they ever needed to sell those stakes, the prices would really move against them. So that's where I stand on ARK. And then separately, I also recently announced a job board, bullpencareers.com, where people can post jobs to hire young talent. So I've got a lot on my plate, but those are some of the projects I've been working on.
Yeah, no, I saw that job board thing, and I thought that was a really innovative idea. And especially, you know, and it's, Edwin, I got to tell you, it's something that that I'm going to be looking at because when you run a firm our size, it's you know, running into people via several of my hires, I think three people that work with or for me, I met via Twitter. Which is pretty amazing. You know what I mean? And I think it's a phenomenal way to connect people because it gives you the opportunity. And I realize it's a jobs board, but you can check in there and connect via Twitter and things like that. And I thought that was a really cool idea. And it was something where I thought, you know what? I'm going to take a look at that. The next time we got a role to fill or we're looking for something, I think that's a great place to start, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, Zach. And you're the type of person who I think would be best suited for it because I know tons of talented young people who are always looking to get hired. And I know tons of talented firms that are looking to hire young people.
Yeah.
So this is the way to connect the two. There are right now about 30 job postings from like DE Shaw, Point72, Citadel. But I'm really hoping it kind of evolves for a lot of the smaller employers to post jobs there because everybody can go to Point72 website and see what's open. Not everybody knows about like the more local or niche opportunities that are out there.
I like to refer it, Edwin, as firms with tremendous upside. Right? that's the way I like to position it, right? You don't want to go to one of those big firms. They don't have as much upside as we do, right? So we're selling the growth, pal.
I like that. And I've also found that a lot of places that have like 5 employees, the interns or young people there get a lot more mentorship and attention. So the big takeaway for all your listeners is bullpencareers.com is the best place to post a job. It's completely free. It takes less than 5 minutes. And I'm trying to make it into a real thing for all finance jobs. So
super cool, man. Well, okay. So now I've got to jump back into the listeners are probably going, oh, God, here he goes. when ARK and Tesla come up, if you're fishing for me, right, throw something about ARK and Tesla on the hook and you're going to snag me every time. just kind of giving away my cards there. But since you and I spoke, I've been paying attention, trying honestly not to pay too much attention because I'm not involved in any of those stocks. And ARK and Tesla specifically, but one of the things that kind of caught me off guard, and I know there's a large contingent of people out there that are going to hear me say this, and they're going to say, well, yeah, no kidding, man. I don't know if you and I touched on it in the past, but I am always very careful when it comes to looking at someone that's on the other side of a trade is me, or looking at somebody who's, research I disagree with. Especially as I've gotten older and done this longer, I've gotten very careful about, eviscerating people that I disagree with and also careful about just dismissing their claims, because it's cost me sometimes, and it doesn't mean that I'm not still, I wouldn't hate to say cynical, but, it's not to say that I'm, no longer focused on reality or I guess cynical might be a fair word. I still am, but just more conscious of the fact that I can be wrong, and want to be careful. But when I started paying attention to the ARK situation, now I'm making a couple assumptions here, but yeah. I'm going to assume that they're not dumb. I'm going to assume that they understand the liquidity dynamics of their portfolio. And yet I've been watching them seemingly increase their exposure to these non-liquid stocks and it at crazy valuations and made me kind of sit, look at that scenario and go, look, I don't want to be a skeptic. I'm certainly not accusing anybody of anything, but it almost looked to me like they're resorting to targeting these stocks specifically because they can essentially, now with the amount of money they've got under management, they can essentially paint the tape. Do you think I'm off base? Do you think there's any validity to that? Or how do you make sense of it?
Well, Zach, I really liked your point that they are smart. I think Cathie Wood is a genuinely smart person.
Agreed.
They've massively outperformed. I don't like the takes on Twitter. Oh, they're just so stupid and lucky. No, they can be really smart. But I think even if you asked ARK, they would say, we're great at understanding technology and trends in technology and where the future is going, I think ARK is a lot weaker when it comes to specific company research and diving down into specific companies. So they know how to play a technology-based theme. They're less good at specific company research. If you look at their analysts, a lot of the analysts have backgrounds in technology, not in financial research. One example that kind of backs up my theory is that they were big investors in Wirecard as part of the fintech revolution. Now, anybody who is anybody in the hedge fund world knew Wirecard had serious issues. Basically, no real hedge fund was owning it, yet they took a big stake in it. And they wrote it all the way down as short sellers were highlighting problems over and over and over again. And it seems like they've kind of reiterated that, where there's a lot of small companies making huge claims about technology. But the moment you start to do real diligence into the management, you see, there's a lot of people here who have a lot of problems. As far as understanding the liquidity problems go, I think ARK might genuinely be misunderestimating it. Tom Stout, who's like their chief operating officer, they don't have a chief risk officer, but my understanding is he's a chief operating officer. Before working at ARK, he was a radio executive at a local Lansing, Michigan radio station. Not that there's anything wrong with radio hosts, Zach.
No. Yeah.
If you look at his interviews, I think he's just been off base, and I've done a few Twitter threads explaining why I think he's wrong. Kathy Wood essentially says, we don't have a liquidity problem because it's the market makers for ARK's ETF that handle the buying and selling and not us, which is like technically true, but still means you have a liquidity problem, because if a market maker is selling a lot of an illiquid stock, that stock is going to go down fast too. It doesn't really matter who's doing the selling. It's just, is there a lot of selling in an illiquid security,
Here's a classic example. I don't know what to make of that statement, because I refuse to believe that Kathy Wood doesn't understand the problem. Anybody that's ever touched anything under $1 billion anybody that's ever traded at size, and I don't care what the definition is, but if you've tried to push through a trade that was 5% or more of a company's market cap, you know what liquidity issues we're talking about, right? I don't care if it's the market maker or whatever. I just can't wrap my head around the fact that she actually doesn't see the potential issue there.
I think the other thing with ARK that might be causing them to not really take this issue seriously is that they've just had inflows every month for like the last 5 years. They've been just incredibly hot, and maybe after months and months and months of just getting billions of dollars every month, it's kind of tough to visualize actually having these problems, but now it's very possible, given that they're down 30% from their February highs and they seem to be getting a little less media coverage.
They don't really have, I mean, let's be clear here. They're not really attracting, typically speaking, your classic buy and hold investor, right? We're not talking about a bunch of Buffetts that are planning on buying ARK and they're going to sit on it for the next 10 years.
That's a great point, Zach, and that's kind of what scares me. It's like very heavily retail-oriented and new investor-oriented. They do a lot of podcasts and webinars, and they send these simple emails kind of trying to break down their investments, and it's very clear they're super retail and new investor-oriented. I think those can be the first to join, but also the first to leave, and they'll be very fickle in bad times. I think that's just highlights the issues even more. If Sequoia put half their assets in liquid companies, that wouldn't be good, but that would be less of an issue because all of Sequoia's investors aren't going to pull out at the same time.
Right.
With ARK, that could definitely happen.
Yeah, that's a big difference. Now, a little bug in my throat there. one of the things that you really nailed, you hit the nail on the head, was your concern about safety issues regarding Peloton's treadmill. That sort of has come into the fore here in the last couple of days. So a couple things on that. A, what tipped you off to that? If you don't mind sharing, I'd love to hear the what got your focus on that aspect of Peloton specifically. Once again, that's one that I really have not paid attention to. So maybe the answer to people that have been following the story is obvious. I just saw the headline come out the other day and I went, son of a gun. Edwin called that one. And I was like, well, prescient timing again. Good timing for the interview because I'm going to ask him about it. So what tipped you off there? And then what did you make of the actual release? Do you think there's more to come? Kind of give us the lowdown on Peloton.
Yeah. So I think a month and a half ago, Peloton announced that a six-year-old died by, like, getting trapped under one of their treadmills. And, you know, I follow a lot of companies with product issues and safety issues. So anytime I see that, I get really interested in trying to learn more and understand that there's a bigger problem. So I just loosely started following the situation. And then, like a lot of people, I became really interested when 2 weeks ago, the Consumer Product Safety Commission basically said, you know, we're trying to get Peloton to recall all their their treadmills. And Peloton was like, no, there is no issue. This is an isolated incident. So usually companies will voluntarily recall. It's super rare for a company to go against a recall order from the CPSC. So right away, I started getting interested. I read all the media reporting. I read Peloton's earlier statements. I read the CPSC statement, and I tried to understand what made their treadmill unique. And just from doing that, I realized Peloton wasn't being honest and actually did have a real safety issue. For example, the law is that you need to report safety incidents with your product immediately to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Peloton said they reported it immediately, but later it came out that they waited a day to report it, you know, which isn't immediately and which isn't following the law. So that was like one small thing where they were just lying about it. They waited a day, but they didn't. Another thing they did is when the CPSC reached out to them for information, contact information for the family that had that death, Peloton refused to give the contact information and basically like obstructed the CPSC's investigation, because how can they investigate the cause of this death if Peloton isn't willing to share this information? Peloton said it was a privacy issue, that the family didn't want to share their information with the regulator, and that's why they didn't share it. I think that's a little silly. Like, if there's actually a death and a real problem with your product, like, you know, you want it investigated as soon as possible. That supersedes like your desire for privacy. But, you know, that ended up being silly because the family had hired a lawyer, and Peloton also refused to share the contact info for the lawyer for the family. And even if the family wanted privacy, there's no reason you can't share the lawyer's contact info so they can start sharing information with the regulator. So that made me really upset at Peloton. And then there were like three or four things in this, in the Peloton CEO's original press release, that just had me scratching my head. Like, normally in a situation like this, where there's been one death and there were reportedly 39 different safety incidences, if you want to be aggressive, what you should say is, we have no plans to recall this product at this point in time, but we're going to be monitoring the situation closely and evaluating new information as it comes in. But like, instead, the CEO is just like, yeah, we're not recalling it. And it's like, you can't just say you're not recalling it. You know, you need to be open to the idea of recalling it if other safety issues come in. Like, every year there's about 8 treadmill deaths, usually with older people. And the fact Peloton had one with a really young kid and a lot of other near-death situations was like a sign that there was something really wrong. And then I wanted to understand.
Well, and Edwin, how long has that treadmill been on the market?
I think like 6 months. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, that's not a very good. That's not a very good stat.
Yeah, and what makes this treadmill different, Zach, is it's higher off the ground than other treadmills. So most treadmills are really close to the ground, so you might slip and fall off it, but you're not going to be pulled under. But Peloton's treadmill is like raised like 4, 5, 6 inches off the ground, enough that like a small kid playing at the end of the treadmill can get sucked under. And that's exactly what would happen. And one kid died. One kid like legally died, but then was resuscitated and came back alive. Pets died under the treadmill. It's like pretty sad, and it's pretty simple. Like, your treadmill's just higher off the ground than most treadmills. It turns out that's a big safety problem, so you gotta fix it or recall the treadmill. Instead, you're just kind of like misleading the public in all your press releases and trying to get in a fight with the regulator. So that, you know, I wrote in my newsletter, like, trust is hard to earn and easy to lose, and I lost like all my respect for Peloton. I think they had a great brand before this, but now it's just like, and now they got a ton of negative, much more negative publicity for it than if they had just like recalled it when they were told to.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about how to say this. I don't want to divulge anything. I don't want to divulge too much, but I have not directly, but I have been involved in interactions with senior management at Peloton, and this again. I'm not acute. You know, I don't know. I haven't researched the situation. What I will tell you is that the attitude that you are expressing is something that I think other people have experienced. I guess I can put it that way, on other issues. I think there's a bit of an air of we can do no wrong. We walk on water and kind of believe in your own hype that's going on over there. I don't know if that played into this, but it is interesting. And again, for a variety of reasons, I need to be very careful what I say here. But I don't think that you're off. I don't think you're off base. That is an experience had by many people on a wide-ranging set of issues, and that's pretty consistent. That'll be an interesting one to watch, because you were right. I thought they were, and I think, you know, they still are. You know, maybe they don't. Maybe this is a big tarnish to the brand. It certainly doesn't help. But you know what they've done is pretty cool. In the strides forward they made are pretty cool, and hopefully they can, you know, figure it out. And hopefully nobody else gets injured. But certainly one to pay attention to now. But before we move on, did you have anything else on them that you wanted to hit on, or I don't want to assume that you were done on that.
You know, so their main product is exercise bikes. I don't think there's going to be anything as serious as a recall there, although some people have also complained that the pedals on the exercise bike like become detached, exposing sharp metal, and then you like cut your foot on it. That was like a little interesting to me, given the recall of the treadmill. From a trading perspective, the company did really well in the coronavirus pandemic. They sold a lot of bikes, so now they're going to be lapping those sales. That might hurt the stock or hurt the perception. I like this CEO, Jim Foley, originally when I was watching his media interviews, because he seemed genuine and passionate and a real fitness guy. But the more I've kind of read, and especially about this recall stuff, I think I have a good spidey sense when it comes to management. And now I'm not feeling Peloton, not vibing with Peloton too much. You know, and I think it's also very possible, like, it's really just an exercise bike with an iPad. I think it's really possible Apple releases a fitness product or some other big company does that really hurts Peloton. So, you know, I haven't done a ton of research on where the stock goes from here. It was down 15% yesterday on the recall. But if you asked me if I was a bull or a bear, even at these prices, I'd be a bear.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. I think there's a lot of bad action in those types of names. The other thing I think, and we'll see how this plays out now, just kind of more of a fundamental level, not really talking about anything scandalous, but one of the trends we're watching, and I'm not sure, and I would think that you've got your eye on it as well, is there's been a lot of selling on good news. That always catches my eye. And then the other thing, too, is, I'm starting to really think that part of the bid up in these tech stocks and part of the run, especially last year and then into the earlier parts of this year, I'm really starting to think that people thought what they saw last year out of those companies was a new growth curve, right? And I didn't really get that was what people were thinking until about a month and a half ago. And I'm sitting there going, you know, I don't think this is a new growth curve at all. I think all you did was front-loaded growth from the next 2 to 4 years and, you know, just slammed it into last year's valuation. And I think these things are going to need some time to digest, at the very least, need some time to digest those valuations. What do you think about that? Do you think that's, you know, because you're seeing earnings reports that in the past, you know, last year would have rallied that stock, you know, 15% in the after hours. Now a lot of these things are getting slammed. What do you think about that? Do you think they were, you know, pricing in a new growth curve, you know, like I was saying, or do you chalk it up to something else?
I think the truth is going to be somewhere in the middle. Some people see the great growth in the pandemic and are like, oh, the growth is going to continue for the next 5 years, and then it's super undervalued. Other people say, well, no, you should really think of this as like a one-time pandemic benefit. I don't think either of those are right, because even like a company like Zoom, once you get that one-time pandemic benefit, 5 years from now, I bet people are going to be using Zoom a ton more than they would had there not been this pandemic, just because so many people are now integrated on it, know how to use it. Like, you know, everybody has this like common operating system, where before everybody had like 10 different tools for FaceTiming and video and that sort of thing. So I think definitely some companies will get a permanent benefit from it.
Whole thing is just saying that I think a lot of these valuations, though, are based on the exponential growth they saw last year. And what I'm saying is, you know, that to me, and I guess I could be wrong, but that to me is a one-off. I just don't think that growth rate over the next 2 years is going to be anywhere close to what it was like last year.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're really right about that, Zach.
Okay, so the other one that you mentioned, and I wanted to get back at because I saw a couple things. How much work have you done on this canoe? How long have you been looking at this one?
Really just like 2 weeks. So I publish on the first and third Thursday every month in the Bear Cave newsletter. So I need to write about a lot of companies. This one I hadn't been looking at for too long. I'd seen some tweets about their negative, like, Q4 earnings call, which went really bad, which got me a little interested. But then just digging around and seeing that there's been tons of resignations got me a lot more interested.
That list of resignations was, I don't want to allege anything. I have not researched the story individually. I've just seen what you've posted. I don't know that I've ever seen a list of resignations like that without there being some type of serious issue. Do you have any clue what's going on, or are you at the stage of this where you're just signaling to everybody, hey, there's smoke over there, or are you starting to feel like you've got a handle for where the fire is?
Zach, great question, and yes. So since going public through a SPAC in December, Canoe's co-founder, CEO, CFO, general counsel, and head of corporate strategy have all resigned. And then the question is why? Basically, my understanding is Canoe's chairman was this really hard-charging executive, Tony Aquila, who previously ran a company called Solera. Once the CEO resigned, Tony Aquila also took over as CEO. If you look at like litigation around Aquila, and there's been lots of litigation, in one lawsuit, Vista Equity Partners said Aquila was brash, vulgar, and belittling to colleagues, resulting in significant personnel turnover, including in the executive ranks. A 2018 investigation uncovered an abusive and aggressive behavior towards employees. And it's like, huh. And then, you know, so when he took over, when he was running Solera, there was abusive behavior and a lot of turnover. And now when he's in charge of Canoe, there's a lot of turnover all of a sudden. So my guess is that it has to do with Aquila being in charge. And if you look, almost all these Canoe executives, who I think were seen as like high quality, who've departed the company, have been replaced by like people who worked with Aquila in the past. So it looks like you had a real electric car company. All the like actually like engineering people had left and been replaced with the chairman's team. So like the new CFO previously worked at Solera with Aquila, the new general counsel, previously worked at Solera with Aquila, the new VP of Investor Relations, previously worked at Solera with Aquila. So you have an exodus of the old talent and just being replaced by this team from Aquila. And the question is this team good? Anybody looking to invest in Canoe, which has like a $2 billion valuation now, should just read the Glassdoor reviews on the company. It's like there's tons of Glassdoor reviews just posted in the last month or two since Aquila really became in charge, saying like how terrible the company is. One review says new management worse than old, executive team has no idea what they're doing, toxic culture, employees crushed by workload. It is not uncommon to hear people crying in meeting rooms. Another review said that was posted last month says fun while it lasted, terrible upper management and lack of concrete business direction, fly by night operation where the business plan was whatever the new investors wanted. Just the common theme in all this Glassdoor reviews is the company used to be like professionally run, and now when Aquila and his group took over, it's not doing too well. They don't really have negligible amounts of revenue. Their partnership with Hyundai fell apart. This is a fact I liked including in my write-up. Canoe's lead independent director, a position Canoe appointed just to make sure there's independent oversight of the CEO and board chairman role, previously worked with Aquila at Solera and then left that out of this bio. So it's like everybody associated with this company is like Aquila or Aquila's friend. And since he took over and doesn't have experience in the electric car space, the whole company appears to be falling apart. Yet the stock's like only down 20% since its SPAC deal. I am super skeptical.
Yeah, that's something that really is remarkable to me. I've never witnessed in my career, I've never witnessed anything like it in terms of what shareholders are willing to look the other way on. You pull up a name like that, like you said, and you see it still has a $1.8 billion valuation. And if you've done this job for any extended period of time, you're kind of sitting there scratching your head going, whoa, you guys still think this is a multi-billion dollar corporation? That investor faith, it really is something else. I've never, news like you're talking about that for the rest of my career, that would have blown a stock like that, to high heaven.
Yeah. What's interesting is, the company now has like $700 million of cash from its SPAC deal and a PIPE they did, and they're losing about $200 million a year. So I have a feeling they're just going to run this runway out. Aquila, at this company and at his past companies, it looks like he does some self-dealing. He pays himself for his own private jet. He leases office space to his own company. The large shareholders of Canoe are somewhat odd. One is like this mysterious Chinese businessman with ties to a former vice premier in China. Another one is this guy named Victor Chu, who I could find nothing on, but he's like a 17% shareholder, and he also bought office space and signed a 15-year lease with Canoe. So there's a lot that's kind of odd there. And I kind of always like to think, how will this play out? My guess is you're just going to have this mismanagement and a huge exodus of talent, and it's just going to burn its cash to smithereens. I think there probably is going to be a fair amount of self-dealing where you say what can we do with all this cash? Well, maybe we'll acquire a related party company, maybe we'll pay consultants that we're friendly with. There's lots of ways to take money out of a business, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because I think at one point in time they did have real technology and they still do have a lot of cash, but I'm super skeptical.
Yeah, it sounds a bit, for lack of a better term, a bit fishy. I'm going down my list here to make sure I get everything in. What else are there? Are there sectors when you're looking for this? Because I think the work that you do is fascinating. I think that the work that Mark Cahotas does is fascinating. And just on the administrative side of it, or I guess on the labor side of it or the work side of it, you know, the part of that job that most don't think about. You know, if you say, you know, I research, you know, for short ideas or I'm a short seller, I don't think people really understand that process thoroughly. And I will admit that I am one of them. I've had shorts before, but it was, you know, I found them through happenstance, right? It's because I ran into them. I've never looked for something like that. What does a process look like as a short seller? Are you working almost exclusively with some type of electronic screening process? Or okay, walk us through your processes or as much of it as you're willing to share, and kind of just tell us, you know, how what that process looks like. How, what, you know, from start to finish, is it organic? Is it algorithmic? Is it systematic? Kind of lay it out for us if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so I would divide, Zach, short sellers who publish research into really two categories. There's the investigative category, people who like to hire private investigators, get boots on the ground, talk to former employees, interview people, just kind of act like an investigator. And then there's a more document-based approach, which is my approach, where I don't really talk to ex-employees. I don't really like do phone calls with people. I'm much more document-based, where I'll read SEC filings. I'll read a lot of litigation. I'll read reviews on the web. And I think there's actually a lot you can find on the web that people won't always pay attention to. I file lots of Freedom of Information Act requests for consumer complaints from the government. That's really what I do. In terms of getting an idea, I'm really active on Twitter. Somebody will post something that just smells a little wrong on Twitter, so I'll start looking into it. Right away, I'll see if there's been any like high executive turnover, which could be a red flag. I'm a big fan of SEC comment letters, which is public correspondence the SEC sends to companies about potential problems. So I'll read that, and sometimes that'll highlight a lot wrong. I'll look at litigation with the company to see if there's been any like high profile lawsuits that are interesting, because I think a lot of investors don't even go on Pacer to check litigation. And I think my real bread and butter, what I'm like really good at and where I can add a lot of value, is Freedom of Information Act requests. I don't do this often, but like when I do, I think it can be groundbreaking. You know, I'll go to state attorney generals or the federal level to get consumer complaints against a company. And oftentimes a company will sell itself one way, but then when you start digging in from a consumer's perspective, you'll see it's actually a lot different than what they claim. For example, there's a car insurance company called Root Insurance that would say, hey, we actually save drivers a lot of money using like our app-based approach. But in reality, they were generating hundreds of complaints from drivers saying, yeah, we got an initial rate that was good, but then they'd hike us 30% every 6 months despite there being a pandemic and make it impossible to cancel. And then it's like, oh, okay, maybe you're not as great a company as you claim to be. So those are all things I do. I usually try to get like a spidey sense for the management. So I really like watching CEO interviews and just hearing them talk for half an hour. You know, Warren Buffett says when he's trying to look at a manager, he tries to decide, you know, are they genuinely passionate about it? Or are they just doing it for the money? I look at that too. Do they have integrity? Do they have energy? Are they wicked smart? Because frankly, even if a company is overvalued, I don't want to bet against a CEO who's really passionate and talented and just say, oh, it's 50 times sales. I'd much rather bet against the guy who's just going to loot his own company for his own good, because like unethical management, they'll always find a way to screw over shareholders. You're always going to lose.
And it's like being with management, in my experience, that you have any ethical qualms about, it's like almost going to bed knowing you've got a thief in your house. You know what I mean? Because it's only a matter of time until even if it's legal, right? You know, and you probably know this better than I do, but you know, I think people have this view that these accounting laws are so black and white. You know, you can do things legally and do them entirely unethically at the same time, right? And, you know, I just look at those guys and I'm like, if nothing else, it's just going to be self-dealing, like you were saying, right? It's like someone's constantly looting the corporate treasury. And to your point, you know, there's some people out there that I think are going to go, oh, this is that. Well, that's obvious. Thanks a lot, Zach. And yet, you know, I see it all the time. It really is shocking to me that you have people that will get involved, and even passionately so, in a company where they have very little to no understanding, knowledge, or even looked into management. You know what I mean? And the reason I say that is because, you know, keeping notes and looking back at my own track record and different, it is unquestionably extraordinarily clear that when I look back on my history, that and I should run the numbers on it, but probably to a 2 to 3x magnitude, that my best successes and my biggest winners have all been where management was a core thesis of the investment from the outset. And it doesn't mean that I wasn't paying attention to it, but there have been times where I've overlooked management, not that was bad, but that wasn't great, that I, like, you know, that didn't have energy, that, you know, that I didn't think was super passionate, but I thought the product or the company was so attractive. And some of those have worked, but a lot of them haven't. And yet when I go with management, the success rate is so much higher. I'm not really going anywhere with that, but talking about your research, it is fascinating to me how few investors focus in on that, right?
Yeah, and what I would say is it's so fascinating how egregious it can get without people caring.
Right.
It's like some of the companies I write about, like the CEO's last three ventures have all gone to zero or all gone bankrupt. The audit committee's chairman has been like accused of fraud. Just like everywhere you look, it's zeros all around. Yet the company gets the high marks from investors, and it's like, maybe there's something wrong here. Oftentimes, I found for the most egregious situations where you could maybe describe it as a pump and dump or really just like lies. Usually, the companies tend to top out at roughly $1 billion valuation. But that's before they like just issue stock to infinity just to get cash and like steal from shareholders.
And if you don't feel free to say that, but do you have any view on the number of these you see out there? Have you done any historical work? I tend to lean, you know, I'll just put my bias out there up on the table. I tend to lean toward Jim Chanos's view of this kind of being the golden age of fraud. Yet I have done far less work on that than either of you two have. And what I'm wondering is if there's any way to know if you know, maybe some of the data and the research behind, and I'm sure Jim's got data and reasons why he says that, but I'm just interested to know if there really is more of that out there. I think there probably is, but again, I'm biased. Do you have any way of looking at that in context? Do you see, you know, is maybe it's your anecdotal experience that you just see a lot more of this trash out there? Or, you know, is there anything to what Jim is saying?
I think Jim is dead right. We are in a golden age of fraud. I don't have any statistics necessarily to back it up. But what I will say is I think the root problem oftentimes is retail investors. An institution that's investing $10 million in a small company will either like look into management themselves or like hire somebody to. But a retail investor is going to be basing oftentimes their investments on like a PowerPoint or a slide or news articles or like,
or
you
a
know,
TikTok video.
Projections or a TikTok video. So when you got all these retail investors, I think a lot of these companies I write about with significant management problems and significant ethics issues, I bet you the retail base is a disproportionate amount of the ownership. So that's interesting to me. I think
because we're really not going to have a scope. And again, it's an old Buffett-ism that everybody knows, but it does appear to me that there's really no way of verifying that, or at least that's the conclusion I've come to, where it really is that scenario where you're just not going to know till the tide goes out, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think once things turn, I think we'll see a lot of these, a lot of companies get exposed.
Well, and the way I look at it is you have to. I mean, look, you know, I don't know what your thoughts are on this globally. you're a more, well, I could say you're a more disciplined, focused thinker than I am. And I mean that as a sincere compliment. I tend to get a bit global. But one of the things I look at, when I see people knowingly investing in things that they know are nonsense. Now, some of the people out there don't know it, but a lot of them do. And I think that's one of the really unique aspects of this period of time. And my listeners have heard me talk about this before. We've seen bubbles since there's been human beings, right? We've seen bubbles. I don't know of one where people were knowingly throwing, you know, real money at things that they knew weren't real, right? Like Dogecoin, right? It was a joke. Some of the other coins that have been launched with more explicit names. There's a coin that launched, was it like last week? That's the title of the coin is a female part of the anatomy. And yet people are throwing money at this thing. That Dogecoin is worth, what are we at, an $80 billion market cap? And the reason I bring that up is you show me an environment like that where people are all too willing to suspend disbelief. There has to be a ton of fraud, right? I mean, you know, there's the lights are on, but nobody's home. I mean, the front door is wide open. Investors are begging for it. There just has to be a load of fraud, right?
I think somebody launched a cryptocurrency called Scamcoin.
Yes, yes.
Like publicly saying this is a scam, and that hit like a $500 million valuation or
there,
something. Like
you know, we were laughing about this in the office because the guys that did the Scamcoin and then the guys that did Dogecoin, in my opinion, I think they're some of the smartest, most appearingly ethical people in, you know, or some of the most ethical people in that altcoin space. And the reason why I say it is they made no bones about it, right? They made no effort to put a veil of credibility over this thing. They just came right out in a mocking way and said, yeah, here's this joke. You know, when there are congressional hearings on it, I can hear those guys getting drilled and coming out and saying, we named it Scamcoin, right? Like, how could we may as well have named it Do Not Buy This Coin, right? And yet people couldn't get enough of it. They still can't. It's just mind blowing to me.
Yeah, it's definitely like, I think a lot of times, you know, people just kind of get divorced from like the purpose of the capital markets, which is to help find and grow great companies, because you want a great company to be able to raise capital efficiently so they can grow quickly. And I think the capital markets usually do that really well. But now it gets into all this silliness. It's definitely frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It really is a very... And you know, if you are a fundamentally based investor, now we're having a great year. We certainly have seen a reprieve on the complete disregarding of fundamentals. You know, as a value investor, I like to equate it. You know, we're not winning the race yet, but we escaped long enough to get back to the surface and catch our breath, right? But it does seem like the focus is going back more on the fundamental side. We'll see if that holds up. Are there any bigger companies on your list that you're looking at? Or do you tend to focus on, is there an intentional focus on the smaller companies? Or is that just where, like you were saying, you end up looking there because that's where all the targets are?
I end up looking there because that's, I think, where the best targets are. Like $1 to $5 billion market cap U.S.-based companies are kind of my sweet spot. Usually when you get to like the $10 or $20 billion companies, there could still be problems there. But usually those aren't companies that are going to fall 80% in 1 or 2 years. They kind of have a tried and true business. If anything, it's going to be like a slow decline. I'm looking for companies that I think could decline 80% in 2 years with, you know, it's tough to get to like a $20 billion valuation if you have management that's just been associated with like numerous bankruptcies and self-dealing and that sort of thing. Because to get to that point, you need a lot of institutions to back you. So $1 to $5 billion is my sweet spot. But I'm not ruling it out. I think, like, to do something on a big company, you would need to be, like, months and months and months of research to really highlight something that people don't know about. But I'm really interested in the payments space and, like, illicit payments and, like, you know, how do like marijuana companies pay, what payment processors do they use, and are they used for like other bad stuff? I think there's a lot of weird stuff going on with like fintech and payment processing.
It just seems like fertile soil for it, especially in that that business or that sector, if you will. One I wanted to ask you about was, and Edwin, the name of it is escaping me, but I saw they released earnings recently. I am just blanking on the name. I've got it written down in my notes somewhere, and I can't find that page. Anyway, there was – oh, shoot, what is the name of it? Anyway, there was – either news came out recently or they announced earnings, and I think it's like a type of gaming site or something like that, and they were – they were giving bonuses to their customers, and then the customers would pay the bonuses for something in the game, and then the company was recording that as revenue. Does that ring a bell to you?
Is that Wolfpack and Skills? Is that it?
Maybe it was Skills. Yeah, maybe that was it. Shoot, was that it?
I think that's it.
Okay.
Skills.
Maybe that's it. Have you looked into that at all?
I read the report. I think that's really interesting because it's kind of like, you know, so my understanding of what was happening is that this was like an online, like, app-based gaming company, and customers would sign up for these games or gambling, and like as a sign-up bonus, like if you made your first deposit, you'd get like $100 of virtual cash. And it turns out, like, you know, customers would spend this virtual cash. The company would recognize the virtual cash as revenue, which like might be appropriate if that's like 3 or 5 or 10% of your revenue. But like one activist short like alleged 50 or 60% of the revenue is just like this virtual cash the company is giving to customers.
Wow.
So the actual core business might be half as big as people claim. I think there's a lot of that, especially with like high revenue multiple companies, because it's tough to fake profits and cash flow. Yes. I think it's much, much easier to fake revenue.
Well, we say this all the time. I think that is such a great point, right? In a market that is so focused on revenue growth and values companies almost solely on that, that is the easiest thing to fudge, right?
Yeah, like, I just think if my newsletter was a business, it's, like, tough to make it fake it, like, to make it more profitable. But I could easily just, like, pay $10,000 to a consultant who then uses $8,000 to buy newsletter subscriptions. And you see that, I think, a lot with these high-revenue, like, companies, just, like, using the huge amount of money you raise to generate revenue for yourself through, like, related-party deals, especially when you're, like, 50 or 100x revenue. I totally think like there's a little bit of like you buy these products, I'll make it worth your while, like maybe indirectly, but I really do wonder how much that, like, I don't like with, like, here's an example I've heard about. A lot of these software companies that are IPOing, like enterprise software companies are IPOing at huge valuations. One of the things they do when they're trying to find which investment bank to take them public is they ask, are you going to be a customer of our software and how much you're going to buy? So it's not just, are you, like, what fees are you going to charge us, Goldman or Morgan Stanley or whoever? It's, are you going to be spending $10 million a year using our software, because they're totally willing to give up $100 million of value if they can get $10 million for the next 3 years from Goldman Sachs and help boost their revenue growth. I bet that happens a lot more than people see, like maybe not explicitly, but I bet that happens a lot more than people see. And from Goldman's perspective, it makes a ton of sense. You get $100 million and you give up $30 million. From the software company, it makes a lot of sense. You get $10 million extra dollars in revenue, which is, you know, extra $1 billion to your market cap or something, and helps sell the story. The only person getting screwed over is an investor, because they look at these numbers and they think, oh, this is real, like arm's length transactions, when it's not. I bet there's a lot more of that than people
think.
Oh,
I'm sure. Now, another one that I wanted to run by you, and I jokingly, again, no slight intended, I just think it's funny. Another one that I refer to is a Kathy Wood special. And I'm really not trying to pick out I'm really not trying to pick stocks out of their portfolio to pick on. I legitimately have come into many of these independently and then after the fact realized that they were in the ARK portfolios. So I'm really not trying to pick on them. But another one that I've looked at, and again, haven't dove deep, so I could be off. But Voozy, have you spent any time looking at that one?
After I published on them, not a ton, but they're actually based in my hometown of Rochester, New York. So I'd heard of them for a while. They'd just been like seen as this company with super promotional management that had like trouble executing. And I think they still do. But for whatever reason, like ARK got behind them and that left me scratching my head.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but looking... It doesn't look – it kind of looks like one of those classic publicly traded companies. And these – the existence of these companies has always fascinated me because I just – it leaves me scratching my head. But these publicly traded companies that almost seem like they try to roll from one bubble to another, right, just trying to catch the hot thing and recreating themselves every 7 years or something. Because that thing's been around for a while. It's – right? It's not like there's some groundbreaking idea that they just brought to the market.
Yeah, so it was like founded in 1997.
Right.
And like, you know, 24 years later, they're still consistently unprofitable. They don't have like a popular product. They fund their business through a lot of dilution. When a short seller wrote about them in the past, they sued the short seller. They had a 75-for-1 reverse split at one point in time. They've issued 600 press releases, I believe, in the last 5 years. 600. And the way they got NASDAQ listed was through an OTC to NASDAQ uplisting, not through a normal IPO. And it's just like, you know, one of their big customers or like press releases they announced was this like guy named Barry Oberhauser, who was like arrested in like South Africa for allegedly like cigarette smuggling. And it's like,
yes,
oh, that
this.
Makes like no sense. And then like the CEO's brother is in like some of the promotional videos and they've got this like this product where you can like put like a Voozy screen on top of your like swim glasses, goggles. Yeah, you can put a Voozy screen on top of your goggles so you can like watch a video while you swim. And I'm like, just sometimes you just like know right
That's
away.
A must. Hey, buddy, that is a must have in the Abraham house. I got to tell you, I am hopping. I always think to myself when I'm going for a swim, you get down to the bottom of the pool. I wish I were streaming right now, you know. No, and that was the other thing, too, that looking at them, and I could be wrong, but it doesn't appear that there's any IP either. I don't. And then on one particular day, now, again, I'm not I could be looking at outdated financials. I just looked at them really quick, again, just out of curiosity. But to my knowledge, this is a company that last year did $13.5 million of revenue. Does that sound right to you?
I think that sounds about right.
Okay. And they're sporting, or at least when I looked at them, a $1.7 billion market cap. Maybe they pulled back down to about $1 billion now or so. But $13.5 million in revenue, $1 billion-plus market cap. I don't see any IP. And then I watched on a day where their stock bounced 25%, which when you looked at their market cap at the time, I think was about a $350 million move, on the news that they got an $800,000 order. You know, where I was just sitting there going, does anybody do the math on this stuff? Right? You got an $800,000 revenue, not profit, right? Just an order. the stock popped $350 million. That one, again, I could be wrong. I'm not alleging anything at all. I'm talking more about the company and then the valuation, but something doesn't smell right on that one.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of a lot of their press releases, and they are just an extremely promotional company. And it's like, you know, if a company was like 4 years in, yeah, maybe they have like really cool and interesting tech. Let me put it this way. I think it's extremely rare for like a 25-year-old company to just like struggle for 25 years and then all of a sudden, like, turn around and become a hot thing. Off the top of my head, I don't know when that's happened. I think it's like much more common that a company like is founded and then 4 or 5 years later they might get an outsized valuation, but they actually have a popular product.
Yeah.
That's going to grow and become valuable. But like when you just see these like companies that have been around for 24 years, it's like you've had all the money in the world, all the time in the world, and you know, you're still not profitable or like executing, or it's just like this time isn't going to be different.
You know, the one thing, and again, not to pound on this, but the one thing about the ARK portfolio that I think I could say is it almost seems like they're taking more of a venture capitalist approach, right? Spreading the seed far and wide. But then if you look at their position sizing, that's not what they're doing, right? If you look at a – I mean, again, I'm not a VC. We've done some VC work. But you go look at a VC's book, they don't have 8 or 9 or 7% exposure to one name typically, unless that name has grown to that level, right? You know, those guys are typically looking at investment sizes of 1% to 2%. So, you know, part of me sits there and goes, well, maybe they're kind of taking more of that venture capital approach – you know, trying to give ARK credit, trying to understand the other side of the argument. But like I said, then I look at their position sizing, and that's not VC at all.
I think it's kind of it. As we talked about earlier, I think it's really that they are good at understanding technological trends. So they think augmented reality for enterprise work cases is going to be a thing. So then they look at like the 5 or 6 companies in that space. Voozy is one of them. And their analysts tend to be young with like really little experience in finance. Like, will just like pick one or two, and oftentimes they pick wrong. So they might be very right about, okay, augmented reality for enterprise use cases is going to become a huge thing. But the company we picked is actually like got tons and tons and tons of red flags. But because they're so good at understanding the technology trend, and because similar to a VC, when they're right, the bets can pay off huge. It's fine that they invest in a wire card from time to time because, you know, it's just a small person. What they should do, I'm dead serious about this, Zach. They should hire me and I will just vet their portfolio, get rid of the 5 worst companies that are complete jokes, and save them like and their investors like $100 million or $1 billion every
year.
Hey,
buddy,
I'm dead serious.
Buddy, in this market, if you did that and if your hit rate on those 5 companies was 100%, that could very well cost them an additional 100% of portfolio growth. Right? I mean, hey, you're picking on the most profitable hot sector in this market over the last 2 years, man. Nothing's paying like fraud these days, buddy.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't hire me.
Yeah, those are their winners. You're going to get the nickname around there just Alpha Eraser, right? If you start pulling the fraudulent companies out of the portfolio, buddy, our growth is going to go with it. All right, well, hey, we have taken up enough of your time. Once again, man, I continue to enjoy your work. And I am incredibly impressed by it. And I don't mean that in a condescending way at all. It's a credit to you, the depth that you dive to, considering your age and your time in the saddle. You're way ahead of the game, and we're going to continue to watch your career in a very interested fashion, and hope you keep us in mind when there's new developments that you'd like to get out there and you'd like to discuss. You're always welcome to come on. And in closing, anything else that we haven't covered, any tidbit? Last time, I you know, our focus and the things we were looking at were really around the ARK liquidity thing. And I think that issue has come to the fore again. Any other interesting things that you want people to be on the lookout for?
No, I would just say everybody should check out the Bear Cave newsletter, my newsletter, and people who are looking to hire or get hired should visit bullpencareers.com. And I'm sure when, Zach, we do this again, I'll have more companies to talk about. But I think it's everyone should do their own research, listen to your podcast, and hopefully do well.
There you go. And you guys can also follow him on Twitter at StockJabber, S-T-O-C-K. J-A-B-B-E-R. And a great follow, throwing out great research. Thanks again for coming on, pal, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Yep, Zach, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. All right, you guys, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back next week. Got a couple different things floating around for interviews. We'll see which one lands, but you're not going to want to miss it. both names we're working on right now are going to be good gets and great conversations. So anyway, have a fantastic weekend, and we will see you next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.